God bless the flag, we all beating our chest. When it's peace, it's the same old game.
I hear something saying, the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, ooh, ah, ooh. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away, then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so dear. But meanwhile, I've got to work right here. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, my, 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 my. My work is so hard, give me water, I'm thirsty, my work is so hard, whoa, whoa, my, 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 my work is so hard,
oh. Welcome back, people. I'm your host, Warrior Empress Nola. You are tuning in to My Skin is My Sin. If you would like to call in, the number is 347-855-8692. And if you want to chime in, you must press 1 to get on the air. And if you, by any chance, want to share the information and people are on the computer, by web is www.blogtalkradio.com/ My Skin is My Sin. You guys are just listening to Sam Cooke. I love Sam Cooke because my grandmother, that was the only song she would let us listen to on the way to church besides some white people, Christian song, because we went to one of those white churches. And I tell you, them songs that he used to sing in church was so boring. But you got to excuse my voice tonight. I'm sipping on some herbal tea, because I was out at a demonstration about voting, and they were talking about the black vote, that we vote every year, Democrat, Republican, and so on, and things never change. So, you know me, I get real passionate about things, and I'm for sure you can ask some of the kings and queens around me how I get. But we still got to put in this work. So let's get into why we're here tonight. We're here tonight about the institutional racism, Stage 3, school-to-prison pipeline. And the reason why, you know, like I always talk about institutional racism, I mean, we've been going through the different stages. And, you know, it's like they're preparing, they're preparing our kids for prison before they even get out of school, before they even get out the fourth grade. Because now I read an article in the New York Times that they were assessing children on how they're doing in school, determine if they're going to go to prison and determine how many prisons they should be building. And not just that, the corporations that we support, they profitize on building these prisons. So that's a really, I mean, that's something that we really got to talk about, and how and what solutions, because the NOLA D movement is not just about, oh, all these problems we have and so on. We're here to talk about how can we collectively as black people can help solve these problems and start, you know, implementing things in our communities to keep our kids from going to prison, to stop all the imprisonments and wrongfully imprisonments of our black people. Because it's not just the kids going, the children going to school, going to prison. It's also our adults that are getting railroaded into prison. So I want to, before I introduce my guest, I mean, I got a lot of respect for this comrade. And I met him in the mission, in the streets. We met on a mission. His name is Dakeem Roberts. We met shutting down Rikers Island. And after that, we just became comrades. And you know what I'm saying? And this comrade, he has a very powerful story, not just very knowledgeable about the school, the prison pipeline, but just about the whole prison system. So we're going to talk about it. We're going to discuss it. And we're going to figure out how we can change things. And Dakeem, he's from the Provisional Secretary General of New African Communist Party, founder and the chairman of the negation. So without further ado, we're going to bring the comrade Dakeem Roberts on. Are you on the air?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, comrade. How you doing?
Okay, how you doing? Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was coming through. I know everything was set up. Okay. So I really appreciate the introduction, and as you said, I'm the founder and chairman of the Negation of the Negation. The Negation is an organization I founded in order to abolish the slave system that we are now seeing. The slave system in the United States never actually was abolished. It simply was allowed to evolve. And what we're seeing today is an actual, final growth and development of the slave system at its highest level. You could say that the United States in the 21st century has 7 times the amount of slaves that the pre-United States had prior to the Civil War. So we're talking 150 years that the slave population has quadrupled. And it's difficult for a lot of people to understand because unless you understand how the systems evolved and what really is at stake and why a lot of the things were organized in the way they were. And it's difficult to really, you know, see these things unless you get the proper information. You know, many of us are misled to believe that the Civil War, for instance, was the determinant event in the abolition of slavery. Is something coming through?
Yes, I'm here. I'm listening.
Oh, because there's some kind of background noise. Okay, it's clear now. Yeah, many people are misled to believe that the Civil War was the determinant event in the abolition of slavery. But they don't know that we actually waged 100 years war. From 1736 up until 1758, we waged continuous, ongoing guerrilla warfare against the government of the United States. We fought them in the glory in the Everglades of Florida, through the South and the Carolinas, while they was always telling us the story of the North and Harriet Tubman, and I love all Frederick Douglass. I love the abolition movement, but that's the only story they wanted us to know. They didn't want us to know that from the time we were brought to the shores of North America, you had Maroons, that many of whom were actually never even enslaved. So you had that type of segment of society, and you had this consistent pattern, I find, through all the countries where slaves were brought. I mean, I found Maroon societies in Jamaica. I encountered the Garifuna when I was living in Belize. They are the Maroons that freed themselves from slavery in Central America, along the Colombian area, into Honduras, what is Belize, that entire area. And always, whenever you find these type of structures, you find a collaboration with the native people. Always you had these sort of instinctual survival collaborations between the natives, natives, when I say natives, I'm of course talking about the people that they call Indians, and the African and the enslaved Africans who were escaping. And this is how we always survived. So you have everywhere the Quilombos down in Brazil. You had all of these Maroon societies that struggled and fought and maintained independence. And the United States is no exception. But they would like you to believe that. You know, even right now, and I mean, I love the war movies now, the Civil War, where I love where our people were victorious, and you know that we were able to swell the ranks of the Union Army after the Emancipation Proclamation, because we were always ready to fight. But don't get it twisted. That's not all there is to our history. And that's what I just wanted to use, you know, for people to understand that we've always fought. We have never been, you know, there's a segment of, you know, the House Negro element that has always sold out. But not all of us are like that. You know, you have the rebel slaves everywhere. We have secret histories that have been hidden from us for years. And it's just amazing when your eyes open up to it, and then you begin to see that. And for instance, I like to speak about it, but you still have it to this day. You have, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but you have an independent structure down in the South that's actually led by a constitutional monarchy. It's the Gullah Geechee Federation, the Gullah Geechee Nation. Okay, the Gullah Geechees were actually the slaves that liberated themselves and fought with the natives and liberated all of that territory in the South, all of that southern territory along the Florida Everglades. All that territory is Gullah territory. We held that down. We held that down for decades. We fought them every step of the way. And this is what I'm saying. We never stopped resisting. And so we have, and they actually have, they're recognized by the UN as an independent nation within the United States. And actually, the actual leader is Queen Ket is the actual elected monarch of the Gullah Geechee Nation. And they're independent.
Is that the same nation that, like, how did they use them as well to continue? Because I'm trying to, I know what you're saying, and I remember we had spoke about it a while back. But is that how they are still being able to use us as prisoners? Like, you know, like once you go into the prison system, you know, as far as the school, I want to kind of tie back into the, you know, the school to prison pipeline. So how is that? How has that gotten us to this point with the children in prison and also with, like, your story that you experienced and everything? How did that tie in to that?
Right, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Yes, okay. So the point in raising this is that I want people to understand that we never just accepted our enslavement, and that from the time we were brought to the shores of what is now known as these United States, we fought, and we continue to fight. And so I try to have people understand that the sole purpose for us being here is for our oppression and exploitation by an oppression by an oppressor nation, which is clearly motivated by nothing but maintaining control over their ability to use us for profit. So what my point in raising this and understanding that the profit motive is what moves them to continue the slave system that exists in the United States under the Constitution. Under the Constitution of the United States, the 13th Amendment particularly, slavery was continued as a punishment for a crime in the United States. So what they had always done was to use crime as a mechanism to continue our enslavement. And this was from the time in which we were used as sharecroppers and tenant farmers. Many times when there was a dispute, always the property owner, who was, you know, a white person, the property owner was always right, and the so-called tenant farmer or sharecropper. And sharecropper, you have to understand, is an evolution of the economic system and dominates and oppresses the worker. So it's a form of slavery, but it's an advancement over the slave system. At any rate, if we didn't comply with that system under the black codes, you could be imprisoned and enslaved. So those black codes were maintained to retain a distinct a relationship of repression and control over the black masses in the South. And it was a unique system, and that's why you had a lot of people trying to escape to the city. And that's the only resolve of sharecroppers is to escape to the cities. And when you did that and you got caught, because they did have patrols, and just like the slave patrols, they might find your body sitting in a sycamore tree, an oak tree. But that's what all of those lynchings are about. That's what that repression is about, maintaining and controlling our labor as a slave system. So the slave system there evolved to a form of feudalism. And feudalism is a system they actually imported from Europe. They used it, though, in the Americas as a racial system, to maintain control over the black population. So for that 150-year period, we were actually in a slave system, which evolved into what we came to know by the later 70s as mass incarceration. Mass incarceration was not started so much with the Nixon administration, because it began way before that. But the new system in which the prison system exponentially was expanded was under the Nixon administration. That was the first mass incarceration in which the system was expanded. The second phase of that was under the Clinton administration, and He sent it through the roof. So it was through these administrators that the slave system was perfected and grown into a massive institution, which produces, for instance, military parts, They produce, I'd say, almost all of the supply equipment for the military. They have tilapia farms in Washington. I mean, they have all sorts of cotton and other types of industrial farms throughout the South. So that system has continued, but it's being used as for the state in order to sustain the system of repression, because that's what the state is. The state is an organ of repression that's wielded by the ruling class in order to maintain class rule. And this is what we have to understand, that those who are wielding the power is actually the ruling class, and they use the state to enslave us. So when you look at the relationship, it's not just simply state slavery, but a fascist system of oppression that is organized in order to maintain control over an entire population of people. And this is what we're seeing into the 21st century with the evolution of the prison slave state. And this is why I try to explain to people.
What about with the school? How are they using that for our children from the school system? What part of that is that whole thing that you just said with the children? How is that affecting them from that system of just coming back from the knowledge that you just gave and the education that I didn't even know all this, and I'm over here writing notes so I'll be able to spit this to somebody else later. How does that same system is taking the kids from, taking the children from the school to the prison? Like, how are they, because you know this system, this prison system, you know how they do. So how are they intertwining that to get and forcing the children into the prison system as early as 10 and 11 years old now?
Right. And they're doing it actually through laws. They can use laws, exceptions. They're using the so-called due process system, and they create exceptions. For instance, they just recently introduced the Senate bill, which I disputed because after I analyzed it, and I'm actually what you might call a jailhouse lawyer, because while I was actually, I didn't get to that point though, but while I was in prison and I was held as a prisoner for decades, but I'll get to that point at the appropriate time. At any rate, while I was imprisoned, I underwent an intense study of U.S. law and politics, and found was that, you know, many of the processes are so contradictory and convoluted, and it's constructed in such a way as to maintain the system of oppression with exceptions and all types of loopholes. And this is done in order to continue the system of oppression. For instance, this governor, Andrew Cuomo, he claimed to have issued a pardon to all persons who were convicted of crimes at the age of 16 years old and under. However, he didn't offer pardons to anybody. And then he put conditions on the pardons. He said, oh, if they didn't reoffend in the last 10 years. So this goes contrary to the entire concept of treating children differently, because now he's putting all kinds of barriers, and he basically offered pardons to people who, under the circumstances he's describing, would be eligible for certificates of good conduct. And all the pardon would be is just an additional certificate, and it's no good because under the system of laws in this country, because everything is based on the repressive relations between the state and the ruling class. But under this system, you have to inform an employer that at some point that you were convicted of a crime, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. So under this system, you're always jeopardized. You never have the opportunity, right, to really rise, because it's a system that's organized around that form of repression. At any rate, what I found when, in the new law that was introduced, this was a Senate bill, was that there was at least a dozen exceptions that continued the repression that would have, for instance, have not kept Khalif Browder off of Rikers Island, because they create these exceptions so that it gives discretion to a court to determine whether or not to treat a child as an adult. So the system doesn't change; it just switches the ability of the court to actually arbitrarily select individuals for repression, and you know who's going to get selected. So it does nothing.
Oh, yeah.
The system continues, and this is an outlaw regime. This is what I want you and anybody listening to know, that the United States is an outlaw regime that imprisons and enslaves children. And those children, for the most part, the overwhelming majority of them are minorities. And the reason why they enslave children, and we have to understand this going back to the history of our enslavement, is because it's easier to break a child than an adult. You break them while they're children. I mean, the things that I was subjected to by the slave state shows to me that they had no other intent than to break me down, to make me a good slave for master, the slave master state. And this is what people should understand, that this is a massive industry that sustains the suppressive machinery of the state. So it's not really doing anything to help the children. It doesn't reform the children. I spent the majority of my time in those prisons in solitary confinement. I was only able to pull back 1 year, and that was the very last year I was there. I pulled back. I was in a prison where I was working with, because you always got to work. You know, you're a slave there, but you try to choose the work that most benefits you and everybody around you. So if you could do that, rather than
rehabilitate you, does it?
Huh?
I mean, did you feel like you got rehabilitated at all, or it was just strictly about the work and the children that was coming in the prison system from the schools? Were there something in there? Is there something that's happening within the system to keep the door revolving with those children?
Well, the concept of rehabilitation is false. The singular purpose of those prisons is repression and control. You have people that can go to college, but you have to pay for it yourself. They took away the colleges back in the 70s under the Pataki administration. So it's not their goal to educate the population, and the statistics. They say, like, you know, anyone that graduates in the prison from a college, it has a 90% chance of not returning. But that's not their goal. If that was their goal, then everybody would leave those prisons with some type of certificate, education. But only thing they do is they put them through unnecessary programs like KSAC, they run it down, and, you know, they talk about drugs. There's nothing really significant done. And then they use labor in a way where it only satisfies a particular purpose. You don't learn anything from the labor that they put you through. This is just manual labor in which you're acting as a functionary or an extension to a machine. They have factories in there that produce metal furniture. You have tailor shops. You have shops that produce soap. If you go in any state building, you'll find core craft. Go in any state building. Look under any chair. Anywhere where you see core craft, all of that is correctional craft, crafted by slave labor in the prison system, tightly controlled, exploited. A prisoner gets almost next to nothing in compensation for the exploitation of their labor. They work 8 hours a day, 5 to 7 days a week, if not more. And let me tell you something. What they get is a stipend. That stipend is enough to get you toothpaste, toothbrush. Maybe it's like $5 a week. So imagine what you can buy with $5 a week anywhere in the world to sustain yourself. So we're not talking about them being compensated for their labor. We're talking about super exploitation for the singular purposes of producing for the slave state. And this is what our children are faced with when they go in there. They're faced with getting broken, with being intimidated. They tried to have me raped because when I went in there, I immediately balked. You know, I knew it was instinct, but I knew that I had to learn to defend myself as best as I could. And the first thing I saw when I walked into Rikers Island was that guys were sparring. And they allowed it back then. I don't know if they still do, but guys developed skills working out, and it was an actual art, a jailhouse style of fighting that I immediately began to learn. And I guess it was the adaptivity of my youth that allowed me to survive. So when I went in there, I went to the cell for 1 minute and came right back out. And I jumped into the fray, and I started learning the art. I wanted to learn what they was doing because it looked like they was doing martial arts when I first walked in. I was amazed, you know, because, you know, they had these defense techniques. Some were called the 52 block, the shoe shine. And, you know, you'd see guys dropping to their knees and twisting and turning and throwing hammers. So I wanted to learn that, you know, and I did immediately, and I became pretty good, I guess. Because I did it all day long. That's all I did. Even the time I went in there was just a fight, during the fight, and developed the art and spar. So I guess having immediately adapted, and I don't know if I was being observed or if they was like, I don't know. But I just know that I came back from a late night court appearance. And I mean, I came back. When you come back, and I'm looking at this in hindsight. I came back at like 10:30 at night. Came back 10:30 one night from court, and it was a little later than that. It was probably a 10:45. They lock you in on Rikers Island at 11:00. They used to. I think it's 9:00 now, but back then they locked you in at 11:00. And I was already in the segregation unit. It's the segregation unit previously going to Bing because, like I said, when I went in there, I immediately got into the fray. And, I got, like I said, pretty good. So a guy got smacked up and he got mad and ran and got a mop ringer. And then, you know, I had to defend myself. So I went and got a boomstick and smashed him up a little, you know. So they took me to the segregation unit. And down there, you had a rogues gallery. You know, you wouldn't believe the individuals that were down there. Even now, I can't believe that these individuals became the individuals that they were. But I'm talking about back in 1977. And these were the dudes that actually were the pioneers of the crack industry in New York City. I mean, movies are made about these guys. And even the guys that were sticking, they were all down there. They were all cool. I mean, these dudes became like parasites on each other, and that's the mind of the criminal element, you know? So you had kingpins down there, and I'm talking about guys like Supreme, Fat Cat, Pappy. All those dudes were down there. I was like, and this is the same. I didn't know who they were, and they didn't know who they were, but that's who they became. And, you know, this is the type of situation I was placed in, right? So the pigs, I came to find out, were trying to set me up to break me down, but they didn't know that I wasn't having that. You know what I'm saying? So
definitely. I can dig it.
So I came back from court, right? You know, I mean, and one of the dudes, I knew this, I ain't mentioning his name because I'm going to be frank with you. I got all the dudes. I got all of those dudes that tried me. I got them back in one way or the other, you know. I mean, you know, that's how you got to live in there, you know. Somebody do something to you, you got to do it 10 times worse to them. So, you know, I had to do, but he don't know that if I ever go back in, because he's doing 100 and some odd years to this day, you know. But
yeah,
if I ever encounter him again, we got issues. Because I'm not over with this. And even though they weren't successful, we got a beef. Because that's how it is, you know. So
yeah.
I ain't going to mention the names, because me and this dude still got beef, and I'm still on parole for life. So if I run, and this is true, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, I could be up in Clinton Max. That's how bad it is, because that's how they got me. And that's what I'm trying to, and I'm talking a lot, but I just need to break it down. And it's so, the story is just so tremendous and ridiculous that unless you understand it and the event and how it interplays with the entire, what I call a prison slave industrial complex, which was organized as a system of repression to sustain the slave state and also to divide us, because the entire system is organized in such a way that it maintains divisions in the class and in the society. I mean, many of the things that have to occur under the circumstances that are organized by the ruling class create divisions and animosity. And, you know, we're going to see that shortly if there's a Trump administration. At any rate, let me just say this. So, you know, I found myself in this encounter, this super thug, you know, and they were setting me up for the, but they were, see, you got to understand something about them dudes. Even though they be gangsters and thugs, they be collaborating with the pigs. You know, and I know the pigs probably told him, "Oh, do this to break this dude down because he's getting too big for his britches." You know, so they jumped me with the intent of raping me, but you know, and it was four of them. But I fought. I told them I wasn't having it, and that I would fight. I'd rather die, and that's how I, you know, I gained my respect, because I was willing to fight to the death rather than live as somebody's girl. You know, I have nothing, no problem with anyone who willingly wants to engage in homosexual behavior, but I choose
but
not to. Right, I choose not to, you know, because I understand the behavior as a necessary outgrowth of human evolution. So I understand it, but I have, and I'm just saying, this is not that type of a voluntary relationship. This is an act of rape against a man, a man child, who I was 16 years old when I was on that island, and these dudes did that for the pigs. But I fought, and that's how I gained my respect. And after that, I never stopped fighting. You know, I went in that cell, and I started doing push-ups. You know, it was push-up time, you know, and I started working out. And I got to the point where I was doing 1,000 of every body part a day. I mean, it, you know, I should have looked like the Hulk, but because I wasn't eating, and my body, I must admit, is highly efficient. You know, I can get fat from what the average person would starve. So although many people who may have put themselves through the same type of exercise regime as me would be cut and all that, my development was moderate because the way my body burns energy. So I had to do those things as a child, and that's how children adapt. I didn't know that I was doing this. I didn't know that I was adapting. So I was adapting to my environment. And, you know, I developed good brothers that were in there, you know, because I met, like, master cell fighters, dudes that could defend themselves from the cell. I was able to develop techniques that were not all fighting techniques, but also I learned, you know, jailhouse chemistry. You know, we had to use our body fluids to sometimes repel attacks, and you had to know how to use that stuff. You know, it wasn't like some bug out that, you know, shitting down police. We knew how to break down the chemistry so that we made noxious gases that would hit them and would make them vomit on contact if they tried to invade ourselves. So we were able to fight them from the cells and sustain ourselves. We developed systems of defense in those cells that allowed us to fend off attacks, but it was difficult because they would bring the entire machinery of the state against you. The only thing they couldn't bring in there was guns. And that's how we were able to really fend off, because they could come with gases and everything, but we knew how to, we developed techniques and how to fight off the gases, how to fight the shields, how to, you know, keep them off of the, you know, keep them out of your cell. And that's why at the age of 18, they brought the state troopers to my cell, because I had developed these techniques. And by that point, I was like a cell monster. You know, I was doing 1,000, I was working out 18 hours a day. This is true. I was working out 18 hours a day, and they never saw me. I never would let them see me working out. And every time they walked by, yeah, I would stop. I would never let them see me, because I was waging war. And so here it is, right? Two of the pigs, right? Two pigs come to my cell, you know, and they tell me, oh, you got a package. You're going to take you to the package room. So I didn't know that these dudes had some type of plans, you know, to hurt me. And as soon as I come out, the dude just pushes me against the wall, and the other guy hits me with a stick, and I defend myself. But they didn't realize that by that point I was at the height of my physical ability, you know, and I smashed them. And when the squad came, I smashed a lot of them, you know, and I did it from the cell, because I went back in the cell fighting, being that I had developed these techniques. And what happened ultimately is charges against me. Here it is. They opened my cell. I'm in solitary confinement. I was doing like maybe a 3-year. I was doing like a 5-year bid, but I did ultimately 3. So I'm doing all of this solitary confinement time. I'm in the cell. They open my cell. They attack me, and then they turn around and press charges against me. So I went to trial on that. I lost the trial, and they gave me another 3.5 to 7. So what I'm saying to you is that what they have there is a system of repression, where if you didn't want to be exploited and oppressed, you had to learn to defend yourself in there, you know, in any way you can. And I probably have.
Well, with the children that's coming through there, is because I just see, I mean, like I said in the beginning of the show, was like how, you know, they're doing assessments on children that if they're not making certain grades, they predict that they will be in prison. So they're making, I had read that in the New York Times, that they're making the prisons because they're not. Now, we talked about all the things that are going on. What is it that, even as just children, for parents, what is that we can do, and just as adults, whatever, however it is, because the prison system is not, you know, it don't care what color you are, you know, what age you are, but for parents that have children in school and just children, period, at a 16, what is it that they can do so that, you know, that they don't become a victim? Because we know the educational system is not a foolproof thing to keep our children out of prison, because they're not interested in educating them. They have another agenda, as you have just how you have broken it down to an elementary level for us to understand, and taking it back from slavery all the way back up until now that we still are in slavery. What is it that parents can do to keep their kids becoming a victim in this wild, wild west, pretty much?
I don't know if it's a simple parental issue. I think it's more of a societal issue. Because parents send their children to school every day. And they send their children to school every day, of course, with the, you know, the intent of their children becoming educated, excelling, getting good jobs, and succeeding in what they consider to be American society. But it's just not that simple process. It's more that children, what they're encountering is that they are being treated like prisoners when they go into the schools. They're searched, they're harassed, they're sometimes arrested. Some of their property is seized. So they have their first encounter with the police. They're made to submit, and they're made to be treated like inferior, and they begin to understand and become hostile, you know, because school safety is NYPD. And it's like that consistently throughout the country, that they're using the police in order to intimidate and prepare our children for prison and enslavement. So you have the system that's organized with the intent to reduce our children, because you don't have this in the more affluent schools. You don't have those type of police patrols. Only until recently, when you had these college shootings, did you have some type of presence. But it's usually a security, a private security presence. At any rate, what we're seeing with the school-to-prison pipeline is that, you're right, is that some children can be saved, not just by the educational level, but it's also a behavior. They're looking at certain behavior, certain rebelliousness, that where they can use as predictors for whether or not this child shall be a candidate for the prison system. And that rebellion, and that's what it's many times about. The average person that becomes criminalized in American society, whether it's breaking with the system, whether it's for instance, selling drugs as an alternate form of economic sustenance. You know, some people don't want to work for what they might consider the white man or the power structure. They don't want to work there. They don't want to become police. They want to become independent, and perhaps they see themselves as private entrepreneurs. And there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. But this is what we encounter. So we encounter this rebellion among our youth. And this is what they're looking at, those that don't want to accept the power structure as the only way in which they should function. So, you know, you find it among students. And this is why many students can also move towards the reaction. And so this is what we have to look at and see how they call from the school system. And this is what creates the prison to the school to prison pipeline and the future slave laborers for the slave state. And
that's pretty powerful, because you know what? When I was at Brooklyn College, and it was some students there, because I was I attended that college, and it was some students talking about a security officer, and she happened to be Caucasian, and one of the students was Israeli, and the other one was Hispanic, and they had a white friend that they were walking to college with, and they would say she would always stop them but let their white friend go through. But and they would come through that same thing every time. And one day we were in a class a while. This was a while back, and they were talking about it was a class speaking about just like you know just like racism and things that goes on in America, and they were saying how it was bothering them, and they were really upset about it. Excuse me, and they were really upset about it, and that animosity was boiling over to like, you know, like fuck the police. You know, I don't care about, you know, the security here and this, that, and the third. So it was building a rebellious attitude toward these toward this particular security officer. So I truly can understand what you're saying right now. You okay?
Yeah.
I can totally understand what you're saying, because just watching it from the view of what they were saying, what those students were saying, is that, you know, it was building up there, and now you're getting a rebellious way about you, because just like you say, students go into school, now they got to check their phone, they got to frisk them, so it's kind of like, dang, I'm going through like this system, not even at that degree of love in prison, but I didn't even think of it like that. Thank you for dropping that jewel. Like, I didn't even think of it like that, but now I can understand what you were saying.
Because if a child's first encounter with the police is, for instance, in the school setting, where they're being searched, where they're being harassed, where they're being degraded, where they might feel they're being targeted, and the relationship is that of an authority figure to a subordinate, and that's how they treat them. So, you know, the person who naturally would tend to rebel against that type of authoritarian treatment would be basically perceived as future state property. You see what I'm saying? Because they're looking at these individuals, people that's, as remember, the school system is organized by the capitalist order in order to train the producers for their profits. They're not. They don't have these school systems out of the good of their heart. There was never actually organized public schools until you had so much surplus value that was produced by human labor that allowed for a public school system. So you have to understand that as part of the capitalist order, that it's intended for a segment of the population to always be like sheep, and they'll do whatever the authority says. They won't go against that, and anyone that goes against it is basically, you know, I mean, this is why you have this huge a following for Trump at this time, because he's saying the things they want to hear, that Americans want to hear. He's gonna make America great again. What does that mean? When was America great? I mean,
that's what I'm saying. When was it ever great?
America has never been great to me. I could point at any stage in U.S. history, the evolution of U.S. history, where we were exploited, lynched, oppressed, a subject where we were charging genocide. I mean, it's constant, continued. I mean, the charge of genocide that's now being placed before the UN is a continuation of the charge from the 1950s. There has never been an ideal relationship between the oppressed black nation in the United States and the American ruling class, or even the general population of this country, because the relationship has been such of an oppressed segment of the society or a nation or group, which is how we can be defined as a subject nation within the United States. And as a subject nation, we have the right to demand independence from the United States. And I think that's the only thing that's going to work, at least for that segment that is resolute. The segment of the I'm not talking to like African Americans. I'm saying that the oppression and exploitation of our children and the prison slave industrial complex is going to continue until we become independent from the American state. And the only way we're going to do that is if we actually declare independence from the United States ultimately.
I definitely can agree with that. Let me let the callers know. If you want to call in, call at 347-855-8692. If you want to listen in, press 1. We got a caller on the air. Caller 1989. Caller 1989. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, caller 1989, you on the air?
Okay, I'm 1989. Good, I got on there just in time.
Yeah,
now,
how you doing?
I understand. My name is James Paquette, anyway.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Yeah, revolutionary activist poet. Now, I understand
okay.
You may want to separate from the U.S. Well, where would you go?
Well,
and
I believe that
would be taking this trip.
I believe that as a people, we are entitled to reparations, and that the only reparations as a people that we should accept is reparations in land and means of production.
Mm-hmm.
We will go to the very area in which we are the overwhelming majority, which we have always held power to some degree. As I explained earlier to Nola, that we held power in the southern regions prior to the Civil War. Even to
okay,
this day,
but now
you have
hasn't that shifted to the north now?
No. That's what they want you to believe. No, it hasn't.
Okay.
Because they want you to believe that there has been this shift. And this is why every time, only thing you hear about is what Harriet Tubman or what Frederick Douglass did, but you don't hear about Gullah Paul. You don't hear about the Gullah Geechee. You don't hear about the Seminoles or the Seminole Wars or the Hundred Year Wars that we fought or the Battle of Negro Fort. You don't hear about
mm-hmm.
how we forged alliances independent of the United States, and we established independent territory, and we fought wars off and on, guerrilla wars, for over 100 years, that we actually forced the Civil War. So, no, they want you to look north, but it's really going on in the South. The South
mm-hmm.
is really where we were organizing and we could be free, because this was the territory that we best moved within. This is why we were able to establish entire maroon societies that wage continuous, nonstop war against the United States. They hid those wars as Indian wars. The only war that they acknowledged that they fought against the so-called Indians was the Seminole Wars, in which the Seminoles were never defeated. The Seminoles were actually the Gullahs, the black former
slaves. The Seminoles were in Florida, weren't they?
They were in that entire region. But they weren't,
okay. They
weren't simply Indians. They were black and Indian.
I know they were mixed because we would escape to them and we became one with them.
Exactly. And what I'm explaining to you is that the pattern of resistance against our enslavement and exploitation is consistent throughout the Americas. You find these type of encampments, and I found them and I've lived amongst them in Belize. You find them in Mexico. We had encampments in Mexico, yes. We had encampments all along the southern region. In Brazil, we had the Colombo, the Quilombo, which were encampments where we fought and we maintained independence. All in the West Indies, you have maroon societies where they maintain independent encampments against the slave society. So we always had these encampments, and I found these patterns in history, and they're always hidden. If you want to read of some of the history on it, you can check out Herbert Apfecker.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a lot. He broke it down. He gave a lot of history. But this is what you have to look at and see these patterns. And you also
I noticed that most of these patterns happened where they didn't have the time to screw our minds, let's say, because what happens mostly now is the 500 years of screwing up our minds. That's why many of us aren't even ready to do something.
Right.
So,
because what they're doing is they're directing our thoughts. They're making us say, okay,
yeah,
you people fought against slaves, but you fought in this way. And this is the right way. Oh, with the abolitionist society and the collaboration with their organizations, you know, they had us looking north when we should have been looking south.
Yeah,
so
but
this is
wherever we're looking, we're not looking in the right direction. It's like,
right. Well,
even when
even
you have
now,
choices,
I don't know if you're familiar with the Republic of New Africa. But
no, I'm
not. Then you should be. Then you should learn more about it.
What is the Republic of New Africa?
The Republic of New Africa is the five states of the Deep South that was declared during a black national. We actually in 1968, a number of the black liberation organizations, including the Revolutionary Action Movement, the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, the Black Panther Party, Barveyites, they all organized this black national convention. Very similar, when you think about it, to the American Convention of the 1700s when they declared independence from Britain. So we organized this convention in 1968. In this convention, we established a constitution which we called the Code of Umoja. Now, it's not intended for everybody to know that we have established an actual foundation. So we have a constitution, and we recognize the territory in which the majority of our slave labor and our population is retained is in the five states of the Deep South. So we made a basic demand, and that demand was that as compensation for our enslavement as a people, that the five former slave states of the Deep South, including South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, all these five slave states would belong to us as a people as compensation and means of production. Now, that was how we established the terms and our provisional government. And different factors were brought in to actually destroy it because at that time you had the counterintelligence program that was operating to basically destroy that, and we were attacked. So they attacked us to destroy the movement. They attacked the provisional government. They attacked the Panthers. They divided, infiltrated the movement. They created all kinds of divisions and hostilities in the U.S. So it was a war. And Huey P. Newton actually analyzed the destruction of our organized systems in his book and actually in his doctoral thesis. He analyzed how the counterintelligence program was actually introduced in order to destroy our programs, which were organized to actually give us independence. That's one of the things that the Panthers were doing. The Panthers understood that we needed to introduce survival programs pending revolution. So what they did is they introduced all of these economic programs like the breakfast programs, the schools, the clinics. And these were temporary programs until we had a new economic order. So what I'm saying to you is that we need to establish a new economic order, a new system of production and socialization.
So we have to start new, you're saying?
Say it again?
We have to start new. We have to begin again because you're saying that was all destroyed.
Precisely.
And what I'm saying is how are we going to go about that?
I mean, we go about that through organizing ourselves, through our labor power, through using and also through charging them reparations. And if need be, and also
you
we
know,
have to organize political parties. We have to organize into structures in which we can establish revolutionary state power. We can be independent, and we have been independent, and we have to be prepared also to defend our gains. So
Let me stop you for 1 second.
Sure.
I agree with you and what you're saying, but I have a different way of going about it. When I found out that the black dollar is $1.3 trillion, I said that, you know, like, we should start holding that back, withdrawing that. And then that's the money that we start working with. You know, like, I don't know whether you agree or not, but
of course I agree with a boycott. I believe that, but I don't think that boycotts produce food.
Not boycotts. I'm talking about withdrawal. We start holding our money, spending our money with us, and then, you know, not just going out frivolously, like just buying, and we monitor
okay,
who we buy
I understand from. What you're saying, but still,
yeah.
You have to understand also that you're dealing with an economic order. You're not just dealing with money. You're not just dealing with a system of exchange. You're dealing with a system of production in which we have to sustain ourselves. We have to support.
But how is it production
so
if you're not producing anything?
That's what I'm saying. We have to produce for selves. This is what, for instance, the Nation of Islam was saying and doing, that we do for self, that we
yes,
produce
they're
for
prime
ourselves,
example.
That we
they're
create
prime
our own
example. But until we can do that, we have to stop holding back our dollars and spending our dollars
back,
with us.
But my point in holding, back dollars,
it may be
it's
a sacrifice
produce.
In the beginning.
Right, I'm fully in agreement with holding back our dollars, right? And I'm not only in agreement with that, but I believe that we should, for instance, transfer our commerce to other countries. I think that we should be trading with, for instance, China. We could buy goods from China, especially electronic goods, and I'm doing it now. I'm interested in,
okay.
like, for instance, computers, cybernetics, developing high levels of communication, and we could buy products from from China, 10, 20 times cheaper, and actually engage in commerce with our own people and with others, and use that in order to raise our educational and economic capability. So there's a lot of alternatives.
That's what I'm talking about.
With
so we are full agreement.
No doubt, but my point is
we
that
just
we
may
have
different ways of going about it.
No,
exactly.
That's part of the program. Boycotting, sanctioning.
It's all inclusive. It all has to be done.
Producing for ourselves, creating an independent. I mean, we could do that. We could take that money that we get centralized, and then, of course, we have to put pressure on them also. You know,
there's
international pressure.
Oh, we got
to
go all the way.
So there's a lot of different levels to the struggle, and we should seek all paths. And if your expertise allows you, we're all collaborating in the same struggle. It's a part. I mean, there's different levels and operations. So we're all collaborating in the same struggle, and ultimately, this is how we're going to gain our independence finally and ultimately. And that's what I'm saying, that we can do it. You know,
all right, that's what I'm saying too. Let's make this happen.
I hope you're in contact with me. My name is Doc Keene, and make sure you friend me. You know, so this way we can communicate.
I'm James Duquette, revolutionary activist poet.
Say your name again.
Hey James, what I'm gonna do is I'm Empress Nola. What I'm gonna do is if you go to the page Nola D Moves, you can go to a.
This is Doc Kim?
Yeah, Doc Kim.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, you sent it to me today. I was like, I thought it was something to go to and watch, and then because I went to the library and I got it on the computer and I was looking for it, and then I couldn't find it when I got home. I looked on my phone. I said, oh, it's a calling thing. But usually when I do these calling things, it never happens. Because I'm like a technical illiterate, but I'm getting better. But it worked out, so I guess it was meant to be.
Yes.
All right, brothers.
Thank
it was
you
a pleasure. Have a good night.
Yes. No
all right.
And tell me next time you're on, and I'll plug in.
Okay, definitely. I will do. All right.
All
thank you for joining us.
Have a good night. Sir.
You too, King. You still there, Doc King? All right, so that was great that you was able to enlighten him on that, and just you know the whole overall of how you know we definitely got to come together and benefit you know just the things that our children go through, you know, through the school and definitely enlighten on how you said it's important. I mean, not so much important, but you were right how. What you were saying about how the children, their first encounter with a police officer or security can almost dictate the way they're going to go through the school system because just like you said, if they come through the system and be harassed, going through security and all that, that's going to make them be away. That's going to make them feel like they got to rebel. And if the officer asks them a question, they're going to be, like, rebelling against them. So I can dig that from your point of view.
Exactly. And what you find in these encounters, and what I found in my encounters with school security and even teaching staff, is that normally where black children are treated differently. I knew I was being treated, and I just didn't like it. You know, I knew from my first encounter with learning about the slave system in the United States, I identified immediately with the slaves. And, I mean, Harriet Tubman was always my hero and still is and always shall be. I mean, I've never seen a more beautiful black woman in my life. You know, I just love me some Harriet Tubman, you know. So my point is that, you know, I think that a lot of things that happened that I encountered, like my first involvement with the so-called criminal justice system, was as a child, you know, where I found myself interned in the system, being accused, for instance, of a murder where the person died of natural causes. Now, you see, we get shot down every day in the street, and they're looking for ways to not impose any type of culpability on police officers or anyone, but let a white male die in close proximity to a black man, even of natural causes, then he becomes the victim. So my point is that I was accused of actually killing someone who died of natural causes, and in a situation where I wasn't even involved, and it was just so unbelievable that they would do this. And then years later, one of the guys that they claim was supposed to be a co-defendant turns up as a correction officer on Rikers Island. So I don't know what they was working with, or, you know, what type of operation it was. Was it to set me up? Because everybody they said was involved with this was let go, except me. And from the time I was in there, I had to fight to the time I got out. You know, and I'm still fighting to this day. I mean, it's 40 years, and I'm on life parole. I'm a child prisoner to this day. I mean, and I'm not going to comply with anything. Let me tell you how bad it was. As a child in those prisons, from the time I was 16 years old until this very day, I renounced citizenship on 3 separate occasions because I had hoped that when I reached the minimum a point of my imprisonment, that I could be deported out of the country. So I renounced citizenship, and when they wasn't even acknowledging my renunciations, and then I finally sued them for the right to relieve myself of U.S. citizenship because I didn't want anything to do with this country after what they did to me and what they was trying to do to me and the things that I was seeing, the injustices, the abuse, the exploitation. I just could not accept it. So I renounced citizenship, and I told them exactly why I did it. I mean, I spelled it out, and I told them, look, you could send me anywhere in the world, barefoot and butt naked, but I just don't want to be here. I don't, you know. So anyway, when they refused to accept my renunciations, I sued the federal government. And in the suit, what happened was certain facts came out, and this is why I'm telling you that they do not recognize a person who has been convicted of a crime in the United States as a human being. So in the court case, they told me basically that I was not a citizen and that I was not even considered human, that I was reduced under the Constitution to 3/4 of the human, and that I didn't have citizenship rights, and that I could not renounce citizenship in the United States, and that the only way I could renounce citizenship is if I was to leave the country, go into a U.S. embassy, issue a formal renunciation of citizenship, and then I would lose U.S. nationality. You know, I had to accept what they were saying because, I mean, it was a court order and I'm in prison. You know, I had hoped that they would just deport me like they do every other person who is not a citizen of the country because, you know, after a lot of immigrants finish their time, even if it's for a misdemeanor, usually what happens is immigration comes and they put them in immigration detention and they deport them back to the country of their origin. And this is for anything as small as a misdemeanor. So what I'm saying to them is, look, when I reach the minimum period of my imprisonment, just put me on a boat, plane, or whatever, and just deport me out of your country. I don't want anything to do with you. And so this is when I found out through the court process that once you're convicted of a crime, you're a slave. You're property. You're state property. You don't have rights. You don't have citizenship rights. You understand? So this is what they do to our children, and this is what they continue doing. This is what they're doing in places like Rikers Island, where they still have children on this island, breaking them down constantly, repeatedly trying to prepare them for the future slave system. And this is what it's all about, using and exploiting our labor, degrading us to the point where we're incapable of moving beyond a certain level. And it's organized around these concepts and these and I even – and let me just finish the story about the citizenship. I even left the country, and I did what they said. Remember, in the court order, they said the only way in which I could lose citizenship was to leave the country, go into a U.S. embassy, and renounce citizenship. So I did that. I left the country. I went into the embassy in Belize, the U.S. embassy in Belize, and I issued my renunciation of citizenship. Don't you know they kidnapped me back here like an Africanized slave? You believe that slavery doesn't exist within 20? They pushed up because, you know, they have – Belize is a weak colonial government. Belize, I respect them. I mean, it's a beautiful country. I wish I could have stayed there. But when it comes to U.S. pressure – they house Negroes. They the house Negroes of the world. I'm sorry. Anyway, don't you know that the U.S. turned me over to the Belizean government because they couldn't cross back into Belizean territory and put me on a plane to deport me. So they gave me over to the Belizean, and the Belizeans held me to, in this rat-infested dungeon, and the next day they came and they just sprayed me with water and hoses and stuff and gave me clothes and took me on a plane within 24 hours like an Africanized slave. I was on a plane to Texas. No process, nothing, no deportation, nothing. Just like a slave, I was property and I was brought back. Even though I went into the Yankee embassy, renounced citizenship, issued the formal written renunciation of citizenship. And this is what I want people to understand, that we're slaves. You don't have citizenship rights. They will reduce you to nothing. And I have actually seen cases, so don't think this is inconsistent, but I've seen cases where people have renounced citizenship and they haven't allowed them. And these are people that have not even been criminalized. You know, this is why people like W.E.B. Du Bois had to go into exile. I don't know if you remember, but when the petition denouncing the genocide of our people was issued in 1951.
That was something that the U.N., when I went to that meeting at the U.N. Here in New York, and they brought up that same petition, and that's what December 12th was referring to that day. So I definitely knew what you're talking about.
Right. So what happened to the couriers of those petitions, they all received some type of reprisal. I mean, the ones we know, Paul Robeson, he was placed on persona non grata. He was blacklisted. He couldn't get work anywhere. He was denounced as a communist and everything else. What's his name? W.E.B. Du Bois was placed into exile That's why he went to Ghana and had to live in another country. So all of the people that were the couriers of the petition to the United Nations denouncing the crime of genocide against the United States received reprisals. And my point is that in a free country, you don't do that. If you have a complaint, you allow those people to complain. But we're seeing that the U.S. time and time and again is using political pressure, for instance, to avoid any type of responsibility, for instance, in the International Criminal Court for crimes they commit, war crimes, crimes of genocide that they commit around the world, and they continue to commit, like in, of course, we know about Guantanamo. And even though Guantanamo is on the island of Cuba, it's not the Cubans that are doing the oppression, the torture and exploitation of the captives on the island. It's the Americans that are doing it, and they're using the island of Cuba, and that's why there's a lot of disdain. They're using the island of Cuba to actually exploit and torture and abuse prisoners, and this is an ongoing situation. So this is what we see in America, and this is why Malcolm X said that America needs prison, because it manufactures and creates through its economic and social order a system that ensures that certain people are enslaved on an ongoing and continual basis. And this is why our children are going through the school-to-prison pipeline. And this is how they break them down and they exploit the slave. And I don't think that everybody, and I had this debate before, I don't think that everybody in prison is just constantly working. It's not. What they use is they use mass internment so that you actually have a massive segment of the population that doesn't work at all. They're idle. And the reason for that is that idle time, because it runs against the human genome, it makes people want to do something. You know, if you're locked in a cell all day or, you know, you don't have nothing to do, you're going to want to do something. You want to do something useful, because the purpose of human life, if you take out the God equation, is to produce and reproduce real life. That means not only human life, but also our ability to shelter ourselves, to clothe ourselves, to feed ourselves. It's all the purpose of life. And this is what moves us forward. And this is why we produce, to sustain ourselves. And it's exploited by the ruling class and for their profit. And this is what we have to understand, that the profit motive is not a necessary motive of society. It's used to divide and enslave the people. They create these divisions through giving more privileges to certain segments of the population. For instance, we know that the white population in America is more privileged than national minorities. And they create these splits because if you look, the majority of, for instance, prison guards in the state system are white, rural men that are supremacists and that believe that we are a burden and a curse on their society. And the ones that you do see, the majority of blacks that you do see on, like, for instance, Rikers Island, these are the individuals that they commonly could depend on as house Negroes. You know, they always had their house Negroes, and that's what these black police and prison guards are. They're house Negroes. They've been totally deluded into believing that they're serving society in some proper way, but yet they go in there and they become a part of the order of oppression and exploitation, and they support it and sustain it. And this is what you have to understand, that even in our population, that you're going to have that segment of our population that's going to exploit and oppress us. And we have to recognize that. That's why I say, look, if an African-American wants to stay an African-American, wants to stay an American, and they want to, you know, be with them, let them be there. Or a black nationalist or a black communist wants to have independent land, independent territory, self-government under our own terms, then that's where I want to be. I don't want to be with African Americans. If you want to stay there with them, you can just stay there with them. You know, we could build our own land. And if white Americans want to come to our territory, they can come, but they have to live with us. They have to live like us and relate to and empathize and work with us, you know, because we're not trying to turn them into property, you know, because we're not doing what they're doing to us. We're not trying to exploit and oppress them. We never did, you know, and this is the thing, but we will not tolerate them placing us in any situation of subordination or exploitation or oppression. Just like that's what Robert McGovey is doing. And this is why I always say Robert McGovey is right. You know, because look,
I can dig it.
Zimbabwe always belonged to the African people. They should be glad that they getting some type of compensation for exploiting the people there for centuries. So, you know, this is what we are doing. We're righteous, you know. I mean, Nelson Mandela never sought to run the white racists into the Atlantic Ocean. The only thing they sought was to collaborate, cooperate, and advance the society for not only ourselves but for our children and our future generations. And this is what we should all be wanting to do, not just for a few select individuals a group of individuals that seek to benefit from everything. You know, that's what the ruling class does. And this is why we have to differentiate ourselves and introduce a new social order.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And that's, I mean, I was, excuse me, I tell you, my throat with that demonstration I did the other day. And, you know, and I always be so passionate about what I believe in. You know, I'm always yelling and being crazy as always. But I agree with you definitely about, you know, getting a new world order. And just like I was touching on earlier about voting, you know, we need a black party. And, you know, and we're going to discuss those things in a later movement and all. But, hey, comrade, I just wanted to thank you so much for taking your time out to come, you know, to listen and, you know, also share your knowledge. Because you've been through the system as a child. And, you know, I really appreciate you. And I'm glad I had the pleasure of being on the battlefield with you a few times. And, you know, I know you're a righteous brother, and I know you for real about this movement, and you definitely is about moving your feet. And that's what we're about on the NOLA D movement. We're about moving your feet, you know, because we can't sit back and just talk about what's going on. We got to put things in action to be better as African people of African descent. So I want to thank you so much for coming in, coming on the show, and spitting that fire for us, you know, tonight. And I definitely looking forward to continue to building with you, because I know I'm going to see you out in the streets and stuff. But thank you again for coming on the show tonight, okay, comrade?
No doubt. I appreciate it. The fact that you are talking about the subjects that matter and that we need to understand. And just in closing, I'm not so much concerned with opposing the existing order than with building a new one. And I think that's what we should concentrate on. And if in the course of our reconstruction of a new order, the enemies of our people should cross the line, we just need to push them back. So I'm just saying, let's build our own, and they better not cross the line.
That's right.
Okay,
I know that's right. you know where I stand there. You know where I draw the line in the sand there. You know where I stand.
That's right, because we're going to do this, you know, because I'm tired. I'm tired of running and hiding. I wanna build, you know. And I'm tired of having to resist the powers, you know, protesting their actions. Let's build our own, and then look at them on the other side and say, "Damn, what they doing over there? Why ain't they come over here with us? You know, we got our own freedom. You know, forget them African Americans. African Americans want to stay over there with them. They can, you know. Let's build our own power structure." And anyway,
well,
you know what
my girl said, and she our hero. She said, "Damn, I freed 1,000. I would have freed 1,000 more, but they didn't even know they were slaves." You know what I mean?
That's what I'm saying. You know, until people realize that slavery never ended, that our exploitation of people never ended, and the only way we're going to be free is to free ourselves, then they're going to be slaves. So,
yeah.
That's the only way we're going to end it, is to come into consciousness of that. Okay. Thanks, Noah. And I'm hoping, you know, I did impart some information to people. And if they want to contact me, they can contact me through Facebook or Twitter. Okay. Have a good night.
Do me a favor. Share your info on the page so if people want to contact you, you know what I'm saying? Just share that to the page, to the Know These Moves, and, you know, send that and everything so people know what you're doing and how we all getting together, because, you know, we got to get out of there. So we'll talk, man. Peace. Hey, I definitely, man, you guys, I tell you, if you ever get a chance to be out here in New York and you can follow up what this comrade is doing, I tell you, man, it's been such an honor to be able to be on the battlefield with him, and definitely to be able to do great things. And he about that work. He is definitely about that work. So, If you miss the show, you know, because I know a lot of people called in after 7:30, 8 o'clock, you know what I'm saying, because I know everybody got busy lives and stuff like that, you know, and I probably would be late to the show if I didn't set an alarm, but and it ain't that we don't care, but you know how this system got us all crazy and turned around at times, but we getting through this thing, we definitely getting through this thing, but if you missed it, you can definitely do it, it's going to be a replay of it at www.blogtalkradio.com/myskinismysin. But before I get out of here, I definitely got to talk about our company. It's called the Renaissance Hair Company. And what we do is we service the whole North America with 100% human hair extensions, including tapes, fusion, clips, wefts, and wigs. And if you want to find out, you know, if anybody you know that needs the hair or uses the hair, you can get us at Facebook, the Renaissance Hair Co., and on Instagram at @the_Renaissance_Hair Co., and Twitter at @GetOurHair. So, and the reason why we got involved and got involved with the hair, and for people who like, oh, that's, you know, a negative stigma, but not understanding the history behind the hair, you know, and we, black people are the creator of all things, but we got involved in the hair because the Koreans are taking $1 billion out of the community every year, and we're not touching any of the market, and we're the ones that's wearing it. So that's why we got a part of this market, and also that so that we can continue to set our people free with this so we can support other organizations to be a part of that. So that's why we got involved in it. You know, this is our vehicle to be able to help our community and rebuild and buy other properties and nation build. But like I always say, you know, thank you guys for calling in. Thank you for being a part of the show. And thank you for being a part of the Nola D Moves. And this is the show where we talk black, we act black, we walk black, and we say what we want to because we black. And we continue to push the agendas of black people. So we're going to phase on out of here. But, you know, if you want to listen to a nice tune by Sam Cooke, stay on. You know, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Thank you, and I love you all. I love my black people. Black power.
I hear something saying, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, ah, That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away. Then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. Can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so dear. But meanwhile, I've got to work right here. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. All day long they're saying, my work is so hard, give me water, I'm thirsty, my work is so hard, whoa, my work is so hard.